Accession number 28351, Reel 12.
Lord Peter Blaker, Reel 12. Could I now ask you about your role in the Falklands War? Because I knew you were involved with this. Number two to John Knott, I believe.
Yes.
And I perhaps we ought to start off with the defence reviews, do you
Yes,
think?
Yes. I came into the job of Minister for the Armed Forces because of the defence review and the reaction to it of a man called Keith Speed, who was the Parliamentary Secretary for the Navy. Before I came in, there were three parliamentary secretaries, one for each service, and he was the naval one. And he was persuaded by the admirals to make a speech critical of the government. The admirals were absolutely furious because they thought that they had done badly from the defence review. I think all the services thought they'd done badly, but the Navy was particularly vocal. And the Navy's argument was that the Trident submarines and Trident missiles should not be part of the Navy budget. They should be a separate, as it were, a fourth category, Navy, Army, Air Force, plus Trident submarine, which was not a tenable position in the view of the government and view of John Knott, and certainly wasn't my view when I arrived there after the defence review was over. But I was brought in after Keith Speed had made this speech critical of the government, because he was instantly sacked by Margaret Thatcher. And she put into force something which I think had been contemplated for some time, which was to have a ministerial structure which involved dividing the ministers on functional bases rather than service bases. That is, you wouldn't have separate ministers for each service. You would have two ministers for procurement, that is to say equipment purchase. And then you'd have two ministers for everything else. And I was the Minister of the Armed Forces, which was everything else. And I had a parliamentary secretary under me. As I say, I was the first person to be brought in like that. And when the Falklands War was looming, we had very bad intelligence from the south of South America. I think economies had been made, and intelligence we were getting was not really very adequate. I remember that after General Galtieri came in as the dictator of Argentina, there was a message from the captain of the Endurance, which was the ship which looked after the South Atlantic in the summer, the South Atlantic summer, every year for 6 months. And it had been decided that the Endurance would be dropped, scrapped. And I raised this when I first came in and saw John Knott after a few days to discuss what my impressions were of my new job. I said I didn't think it was right to scrap Endurance, because that would give a bad message, the wrong message, to Argentina, because they would take that as a sign of British weakness. And he said, well, he understood that point of view, but he really couldn't go on arguing with the admirals anymore. He'd argue with them at time, you know, day after day after day. And eventually he put the question to them, would you rather have Endurance, or would you rather have an extra ship in the North Atlantic, a destroyer or a frigate? And they said the latter. So they were happy to give up Endurance.
It was their decision, really, was it?
Well, it was Knott's decision, but he gave them the opportunity of giving their view. And of course, the announcement that we were going to give up Endurance was taken by the Argentines as a sign of British weakness, a sign of our lack of interest in the Falklands. And in addition, as I was saying a moment ago, we didn't have much intelligence coming from that part of the world. But the captain of Endurance, which was out there, right down at the southern end of South America at the time, we had a message from him saying that there were signs that this new regime in Buenos Aires was going to be more aggressive, that when his ship's crew played a football match against the Argentines at some port right down at the end of southern end of Argentina, the Argentines were less friendly than they had been before, which turned out actually to be rather a perceptive view. And then, of course, the Argentines sent a ship to South Georgia, to a separate island from the Falklands, British, and it had a whaling station or something of that kind there. And the Argentine ship did something rather odd. I think it was loading scrap or something like that. That was the explanation of why it was there. So I don't think there'd been an Argentine ship in South Georgia for a very long time. So that was a ground for suspicion. But when it actually, we thought there might be an invasion of the Falklands. But when it came, the warning we had that it was about to happen was when the Argentine fleet, which had been at sea in the South Atlantic with the Uruguayan Navy, because they had annual exercises at that time of year, when it ended the exercises, instead of turning west to go back to Argentina, it turned south. There was only one thing in the direction, in the southerly direction, and that was the Falklands. So we knew from that, that was on the Wednesday evening, and the invasion was on the Friday morning. So we had this meeting in the Prime Minister's room in the House of Commons, and it was attended by John Knott and only one of the chiefs of the services, which happened to be Admiral Leach, who was the first Sea Lord. He was, happened to be handy at the time. So he was in luck. And the Prime Minister said to him, "Henry, can we do it?" Meaning, can we recapture the island if it's taken, which quite clearly was going to be taken. And he hit the table like that with his fist. He said, "Yes, Prime Minister, we can do it." So he had the first word. It was, of course, agreed by all the chiefs of staff. The chief of the defense staff was at that time in New Zealand, so he couldn't speak up. But it was agreed by them all when they had a formal meeting that we should have a go. So it was a very brave decision, because it looked extremely precarious, given that you couldn't fly directly to the Falklands. You had to use Ascension Island, which is an awful long way from the Falklands still. And you had to get a task force together, and very quickly. And I was astonished. I was responsible, as I say, for all personnel matters, all armed force matters, everything except procurement of equipment. And I saw the armed forces get together a task force within 48 hours. It was absolutely astounding. From Friday morning, when we knew that the islands had been invaded, until 48 hours later, the task force has got together. But quite astonishing, with great efficiency. A lot of people rallied round. I went down to Portsmouth to see the fleet assembling, and I saw there with his, he was in just in the water up to his knees with a little rowboat, a retired admiral, was no longer serving in the Navy. I said, "Hello, how are you?" And he said, "I'm doing what I can to help." So he was an example of people turning out and helping. So, of course, the dockyards had to get organized. We happened to have, by chance, two aircraft carriers available. One of them, I think, was about to be sold to the Indian Navy, or had just been sold, but it was retained anyway. So we had two carriers in the task force, which was a tremendously important factor. And we had lots of ships, including civilian ships, and off the task force set, and really within an amazingly short time. Great tribute. The Navy, I suppose, are the principal operators in this thing, getting the task force together, but the Army and the RAF were involved, because the RAF was supplying Harrier aircraft for the carriers. So off they went, and of course it took a long time to get to the Falklands, or to get to the area of the Falklands. There was a bit of a sort of red herring event, which was a nuclear-powered submarine putting in at Gibraltar just about that time, just before the Argentine invasion. And this was taken to indicate that we had already sent this submarine. We hadn't. It was due in Gibraltar anyway. But it was taken to mean that we meant business, which was okay. It was quite helpful. So off they went. And then for quite a long time, one waited for the television news at midday. At midday, our time was dawn, Falkland's time. And the news came through first, I think, on television, certainly first to me. I didn't receive all the telegrams which might have been sent by the armed forces. I wasn't on that net. So the first thing I learned was what happened. You know, when a British ship was hit, I can remember when the Sheffield was hit, quite a lot of lives were lost at that time. So I waited nervously to see what was going to come over the news every morning. The situation was made a bit more difficult because some of the ships, some of the merchant ships included, had very fast communications with their masters in England. And some of the naval ships too, if not all of them, very fast communications. And Max Hastings, who was then a junior person in the newspaper world, but a very bold chap, he was dressed as if he were a brigadier and persuaded somebody to take him out to one of these ships that had these very rapid communications and communicated directly with his editor in London, which was not at all the right thing. So it's an example of how it was a little bit more difficult to manage the public relations of this affair than it might have been. The other function I had, well, my main function was really to back up John Knott. John Knott was in the war cabinet, so his mind was entirely on fighting the war. My job was to look after the rest of the shop, to see that he wasn't bothered by things that he didn't need to be bothered by, which I could sort out. So that was actually quite an important job, but it wasn't so exciting as his job. But I very much enjoyed, if you can say that's the right word, I find it all extremely interesting. One of the main problems was the dockyards, because they, of course, were deeply involved. And as I remember, Plymouth had a lot of, it fitted out a lot of ships, prepared a lot of ships. Portsmouth quite a lot. Chatham, only one. And so Chatham, that's all Chatham had. It wasn't Chatham's fault. Only one ship happened to be near Chatham. Therefore, they fitted out only one ship. So there was a bit of a fuss about the fact that Chatham had had only one. But time didn't allow us to send ships from Portsmouth to be fitted out at Chatham. So there was a bit of a fuss about that in the House of Commons, because the member for Chatham was very vocal in support, as understandably in support of his constituency. But the dockyards did extremely well, worked round the clock, fitted out a great number of ships, both Plymouth and Portsmouth. The other matter of interest is the sinking of the Belgrano. And I was in the firing line for that, because there I was the Minister of the Armed Forces, the number two in the department, and I had to answer questions in the Commons as well as John Knott answering them. And you remember that the Belgrano was sunk south of the Falklands by a torpedo from a nuclear-powered submarine. And Tam Dyel, who has just retired as father of the house in April 05, asked a question, which I answered, a written question: in what direction was the Belgrano heading when she was sunk? And the answer was 270 degrees, which of course was straight back to Argentina. Whether it would have stayed on that course, I don't know, but this was taken by Tamdiel to mean that it wasn't necessary to sink the Belgrano because it was going home. Well, who knows where it was going? It had been part of a pincer movement going north and south of the Falklands. The Belgrano was south of the Falklands, accompanied by, I think, a destroyer. And a number of Argentine ships were north of the Falklands, and it looked as though they were making a pincer movement on the task force, which was east of the Falklands at that time. And so we couldn't possibly let the Belgrano turn round. It could have turned round to 90 degrees within 10 minutes if it wanted to do so. So we had to sink it if we had the chance of sinking it, and we would not have been pardoned if we hadn't done it. The Navy would have been in great trouble if they hadn't done it. So there was nothing in Tamdiel's claim, although it became quite a celebrated case. And now he's recorded on his retirement from the House of Commons, when he's mentioned in the press reporting about who's retiring, he's attached to the Belgrano still, you know, the Belgrano being one of his finest moments. The whole point was really not very important, although it was blown up by the media. And of course a lot of Argentine sailors lost their lives. They're done by that.
They made a lot about the Belgrano being out of the exclusion zone. Am I right?
That was made. A point was made. But the exclusion zone never involved us saying we will not sink an Argentine ship outside the exclusion zone. So we didn't break any word that we'd given. I think it was just outside the exclusion zone. But we couldn't have. It would have been absolutely insane not to sink her.
And who gave the order for the sinking? Was it
Morgan? It was okayed in London.
It was London?
Mm. Yeah. I don't know who gave the order. But the submarine commander referred back.
Yes. Was it seen as a very much a touch-and-go situation, the Falklands, you know, because of the distance involved and also the Argentinian strength?
The Argentine strength lay principally in their airmen. They had very good pilots, and very brave pilots. And one of the factors which worked in our favour was that the Argentine bombs very often didn't explode. And the reason for that was the Argentines were flying very low so as to avoid being shot down, because, of course, if they were there, they couldn't be seen until the last minute. And the result of their flying so low was that their bombs didn't get fused in time before they reached the ship or the surface of the sea, because they were fused by the rotation of a little propeller in the nose of the bomb. And that took a certain time to fuse the bomb. And there wasn't enough time when you're dropping a bomb from a couple of hundred feet as opposed to several thousand feet for the bombs to be fused. So we were lucky in that way. But I suppose you can say that if the Argentines had been flying higher, we would have shot down more of them. So that was a very painful experience. The Argentine flyers, and I say painful, when they did bomb a ship and caused loss of life on our side, which happened to quite a number of ships, that was quite a worry. And, of course, we didn't know when we got there how it was going to work out, because there we were exposed on the open sea, Argentina quite close by. The other factor was the Exocet missiles, which were self-guiding missiles which homed in on a target, especially a metal target. And I remember one event which caused us great concern. That was the sinking of the Atlantic Conveyor, which was a big ship carrying a great deal of important cargo. This happened rather late in the campaign, fortunately, carrying a lot of helicopters for our troops and other vehicles for use on the land, and a lot of ammunition and supplies. And what happened there was that the Atlantic Conveyor did not have what was called chaff, C-H-A-F-F. Chaff was metal flakes which were shot into the air if a ship thought it was about to be attacked by an exocet, and the chaff decoyed the exocet onto the chaff and away from the ship. And the trouble was that the Atlantic Conveyor didn't have any chaff to fire, because it was a civilian ship and had been sent out there at very short notice. It hadn't been time to equip it, as one would have liked to do it if there was more time. And so the missile that was fired, the one which eventually hit the Atlantic Conveyor, at first fastened onto a destroyer or a naval warship, and that fired its chaff, which decoyed the missile. So the missile went over the naval ship, and the next thing that it saw, the mechanism of the exocet saw, was the Atlantic Conveyor. So it went straight for the Atlantic Conveyor, which couldn't fire the chaff. So that was a very serious blow. That was late on in the campaign. Fortunately, the campaign ended fairly soon after, and therefore the loss of the helicopters and so on was not quite so serious as it would have been if this had happened earlier.
Yes, I expect the landing, that was a tense moment, was it, when the landings were coming?
Yes, because one couldn't be certain what Argentine troops they would meet. We couldn't be certain how many ships would be sunk in the course of the landing, because they would have been visible to the Argentine pilots, and were visible. So yes, that was a very anxious time. All went very well in the end. I think the planning must have been extremely good. Yes. And we did, of course, have that terrible event with the ship that caught fire when the men were not disembarked, and a lot of people were very badly burned.
Yes, did that cause a great deal of distress at home?
Oh, yes. Very much so, yeah. Yes, I was in a meeting when we heard that news with the military.
Yes, when it came, the sort of end of the invasion and the victory of that war came very quickly, it seemed.
Yes.
Was that surprising? You know, was that a joyous thing that surprised?
I don't think it was surprising. I think we knew once we'd got enough troops ashore that we were going to win. But of course, there were lots of hazard minefields, which are still there, many of them, laid by the Argentines without any mapping. When we lay minefields, we record where we put them. Argentines didn't do that. So mines were a problem. And the Argentines did fight, in some cases, really very well. Tumble Down, I think, was a mountain I remember, which had a very, very fierce fight on it.
Mm-hmm. Were you in touch with Margaret Thatcher throughout this time, you know, directly? I wondered, you know, if you got any idea of how she was coping with it.
I didn't see her very much. She didn't have much spare time. I'm sure she was, I saw her a bit, but only briefly. But she was coping extremely well. I mean, once she'd taken the decision, which was a very brave decision, considering the risks, then she put herself heart and soul into it and didn't show any sign of, as far as I was concerned, of anxiety or distress.
You were saying about the public's relations that, you know, you were rather out of control because of the distance. But talking to the reporters there at the time, they feel that they were very controlled, that they had very little leeway, apart from Max Hastings, I think.
Well, I think that you're talking about the ones who were in England.
No, these are in the people who actually went to the task force. People
well,
like
certainly.
Michael Nicholson and Brian Hanrahan and others.
Yes. Well, certainly, we were actually in new territory as far as relations with the media were concerned, because of new technical developments. And so maybe the ministry was, I'm sure it was stricter than the reporters would have wanted, but possibly in this new environment, because we hadn't had this sort of thing really since about 1945 in any serious way. I suppose Malaya was a serious war, but I don't think these problems arose. So I dare say that we it's possible that we were over cautious.
Yes, I was told by one reporter who was there, not Max Hastings, by the way, that there were no actual pictures coming from the Falklands because of the time delay in sending videos back and obstructions perhaps by the Navy, which probably would have been Navy decisions rather than government. Is that right?
I don't know. Don't know the answer about that. The Navy would have been super cautious because, of course, if you lose a ship, it's worse than losing several men, isn't it? On the ground.
You were saying earlier you tended to watch the TV news midday to get an idea of what was going on.
Yeah, well, because that was the first thing available to me, and it was reporting what was happening at daybreak out there. So nothing much was happening in our time before 12 noon.
And John Knott, of course, was the spokesman, wasn't he?
He was the spokesman. And he was part of the War Cabinet with Margaret Thatcher, meeting daily. There were only about five members of the War Cabinet. Margaret Thatcher, I think, had asked Harold Macmillan on some occasion what was his advice about having a War Cabinet. And she, I think, said publicly later on, he said, keep it small, small as you can. Mm. Good advice.
End of Reel 12, Sir Peter Blaker. Sir Peter Blaker, Lord Blaker, am I demoting you? Lord Blaker, Reel 13, I hope you're not superstitious.
Yeah.
John Knott had a very distinctive style, I think, in his reportage of the Falklands War.
He had a very original mind, original. Original is the right word. Mind. A bit idiosyncratic. He was his own man very much. I don't know that that I go along with what you've just said all the way. Could you repeat your question?
Yes, he seemed to have a very distinctive style, which was very sort of slow delivery and very sort of plain delivery. There was no sort of drama with it at all. It was just a very straight delivery. I think it impressed people that it was, you know, a rather different style than, say, that you would have got from, say, a television presenter.
You're talking about his speeches.
His speech. When he presented the news to the public, which I think he tended to do, didn't he? What was going on every day?
Oh, the person who had the slow style was the spokesman for the ministry, whose name I can't remember.
Well, was it not John Knott?
The spokesman appeared every day.
Yes, I'm confused.
Yes,
with him.
He was an official.
Yes.
And I can't remember his name.
Yes,
but he became really a public figure. He started off with this incredibly slow delivery, rather lugubrious tone of voice, and he continued all the way through the whole campaign to be the spokesman, and continued with this method of delivery. I wish I could remember his name, but it's available to you.
Yes, now you say mention him, I can see him.
Yes.
And compare him with John Knott.
John Knott didn't speak slowly.
He wouldn't have done it anyway.
No, that's right, he didn't.
No, I beg your pardon. Yeah. That should be rubbed out if I could rub it out, but I can't. But this was something else that bothered some of the reporters in situ in the Falklands, that they didn't have the job of presenting what they were seeing.
I'm sure a lot of them thought they could have done it better.
Did Max Hastings cause much annoyance for what he was doing? Did he, for instance, give away things that he shouldn't have been giving away?
No, I don't recall that happening. It didn't cause much annoyance. He was known to be a fairly robust sort of fellow. And there was a slight vexation when he got onto this ship and sent a message direct to his editor in London. without it being cleared, but that soon passed.
The other thing I was wondering, you know, getting this task force together, and you were saying about the two carriers you were able to get. Now, had the defence review been carried out and various ships scrapped and perhaps a carrier sold, am I right in thinking?
Carrier had been sold, but not delivered.
But if it had been delivered...
Oh, we would have been in trouble. If we'd had only one carrier, it would have been much more difficult. We'd say...